From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Soldiers return from war changed. It's always been so, and it's always been a challenge, a very evident challenge in America's last decade and more of war. In Roxana Robinson's new novel, Sparta, a young Marine who has studied the classics, ancient Greece, the Spartans, comes back from Iraq. He's wound tight, suffocating. His loved ones can't understand his struggles, and he can't explain them. His issues are still life and death. This hour, On Point, novelist Roxana Robinson and her novel of a warrior's homecoming, Sparta. You can join us on air or online where this conversation never ends. Iraq, Afghanistan veterans, is this your story? Does Robinson capture it? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now is Roxana Robinson. She's author of four previous novels, three collections of short stories, a biography of Georgia O'Keeffe. Her latest book is Sparta. The Washington Post calls it a tour de force of emotional insight, moral nuance, and intellectual depth. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Roxana Robinson, welcome back to On Point.
Hi, Tom. It's nice to be here.
It's great to have you back. Wow, you went on a big journey yourself to do this book. Would you just introduce us to your protagonist, your vet home from war, Conrad Farrell, and he's a classics major. What he learned from the classics that may have helped send him off to war?
Yeah, he is 26 years old. He is just coming out of 4 years in the Marines, and he majored in classics at Williams before he signed up. And it was very interesting to me to learn the very close connection that exists between the Marines and the ancient world, and particularly Sparta, the city-state that was created really to exist in a state of war. And once I learned about that, I found it a very powerful link for me, a way for me to get into the mind of a Marine lieutenant. So he has been in Iraq twice, deployed to Ramadi and Haditha, and he comes home to his family in Westchester and finds himself strangely unable. He didn't really expect this. Strangely unable to enter the world he left behind.
The young men and women who have gone to these wars have gone from all kinds of settings. I mean, his is not the stereotypical. He's not gone out of economic need. He's, you know, relatively comfortable family. His parents shocked when he said he was going to join the Marines, and he joined even before 9/11, which was a prod to any number of young men and women a decade and more ago. What made him join, in your telling?
He was really, it was very interesting to me to learn that a whole generation of young men and women had signed up for the military out of reasons of idealism. And I just heard from a military spouse a day or two ago who told me that she was shocked that civilians didn't realize this, that an idealistic impulses were really the primary force for a whole wave of people enlisting in the military. So that's what Conrad felt. He wanted a greater challenge than the idea of going to business school offered or law school. He wanted something that would test him on all levels. And he wanted to serve. He wanted to feel that he was serving the world, that he was making the world a better place. And he thought the Marines, which demands a very high level of commitment, would offer him a chance to do those things.
His parents had a very different sense of military service, being kind of 60s kids. It wasn't where military service was not what idealism suggested to them in your telling. Did he take something out of the classics that turned him in that direction, out of his study of Sparta?
Well, it's interesting. In the ancient world, of course, the ancient world was like this world in many ways. People got up in the morning and had breakfast and fed the kids and fed the dogs and led their lives. But the accounts that we have of it, many of them are written by people, mostly men, who glorified the idea of war and found war as one of the great professions and the great adventures. And so that's the record that we have. And we have these heroic ideals, and we have the Iliad from Homer, who writes incredibly powerfully about what it's like for young men. And also, he always includes the consequences of death. So he will describe a battle scene in which someone is killed horribly and
run through
with a sword, and he describes where the sword enters the body and where it goes, drives through the body. But then, so you're horrified, but exhilarated by this incredibly powerful moment. And then immediately he reminds you of the parents of this child, this son, who are waiting in their house on the hillside for the footsteps that they'll never hear again of somebody, of the son walking up the path to the house. So Homer presents this glittering but emotionally riveting image of what war was like. And it's that sort of gloriousness and the emotional power that is delivered to classics majors who read those accounts of war. And that became very powerful for Conrad, and he felt this strong connection to a historical tradition of challenge and courage and nobility, really. On the field.
As a young man who wanted to make a difference, and he went off to that war. You tell much of that. He comes home in your telling. We should read just a bit for us, Roxana, when your character, Conrad Farrell, is on the airplane, returning from his second tour of duty in Iraq. He's been in the Marines for 4 years. And just the sounds of the descending airplane began to hint at the trauma ahead for him as he returns to civilian life, life at home. Could you read something there for us?
Yeah, this is on the airplane. He could feel it coming, the moment in which you heard the sound. It was before anything had hit, when the air was full of ozone, the moment in which you understood that something was happening, but not yet what. It was the moment that you knew in your body before you knew it in your mind, the moment when you felt the sound, like a great silence taking you over, the shock wave rolling through your body, your heart, your lungs, time stopping around you, everything flying apart into fragments. That limitless, radiant moment, glittering behind your eyelids before you knew. He was frozen and still, his muscles clenched. His palms were sweating. Inside, he was huge and cavernous, and his heart was doing something monstrous. Tears, horribly, brimmed at his eyelids. Some avalanche was poised, ready to break loose. He couldn't stop it. Something was running riot through him, some cloudburst of panic and confusion, noise and smoke and terror. He was consumed by fear. It was sweeping through him as though he'd been overtaken by fire, as though he were now rippling and radiant with flames. Somewhere he was screaming. Terror was blowing him apart.
Roxana Robinson reading from her new novel, Sparta. And of course, that's all going on inside his mind as you tell it, but all he's really doing is descending in an airplane. But he's reliving incoming explosives in Iraq, an IED maybe in Iraq. There's something quite normal around him, but not within him.
Yes, normal events trigger flashbacks, and those trigger interior sort of evolutions that he can't control. So he re-experiences the sensation of being blown up by an IED, or yes, mortar rounds coming in. And it makes his life terrifying because he never knows when one of these sounds is going to appear, and he can't control his own responses.
I agree with the Washington Post when they talk about your emotional insight here and moral nuance and intellectual depth. What's a writer like you, never been to war, doing diving so deep into this experience? What drew you here, Roxana?
It's even more remote for me than it sounds. I'm also a Quaker. Not only have I never been to war, I grew up in an environment where we didn't have much contact with the military. But that doesn't mean I have no connection. But I was struck by this situation probably 6 or 7 years ago. I don't remember exactly when it was, but I saw an article in the New York Times about our troops in Iraq and the fact that they were driving around in, they were forced to go out on patrol in unarmored Humvees, mm-hmm. driving over roads studded with IEDs, and they were being blown up and receiving traumatic brain injuries, and the military was reluctant to diagnose these because the treatment was expensive and it meant removing combatants from the field. And I was so disturbed by the idea that we would put our young men in this kind of situation in which they were unprotected and unsupported and uncared for. I was really shocked, and I started reading more about it. I couldn't believe that we were actually doing that. I had thought we were meant to be the greatest military force in the world, and that we would never treat our troops like this. So I started reading everything I could find. Not the larger political stories, but I wanted to know what it was like to be a combat soldier on the ground in Iraq. And I read as much as I could, and then I realized it was taking me over and I was going to write about it.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with Roxana Robinson about her new novel of a U.S. Marine coming home from war from Iraq. It's called Sparta. She joins us from New York City. Roxana, we've got people lined up to talk with you. Randall in Norfolk, Virginia, military country. Randall, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Roxana, I want to thank you so much for what you've written and for calling attention to what our military members are suffering. I'm an Army retiree myself. I have a brother-in-law that's still suffering from Vietnamese PTSD from his exposure there. I did a counseling degree on my GI Bill, and as I work in a prison, I was presented with numerous veterans who were suffering from undiagnosed PTSD, but after their honorable service and their discharge, ended up with them in drug or alcohol and had them in prison. And our conversation today is so important to make it safe for people to talk about this subject. I'm sorry, I'm so emotional.
No, it's okay. It's entirely okay, Randall. But if I may, what's the source of your emotion? Is it their suffering or our failure to talk about it more, to deal with it with the vets?
As a counselor, I have to keep it together when
sure.
I'm working with people. But the pain and the grief. One young man, his cousin who's been in Afghanistan, committed suicide in front of him. The horrendous stories that I've heard as a result of our military not properly diagnosing and treating young people who have returned with PTSD from combat situations.
Wow.
Would tear your heart out of your chest.
We hear it. Roxana Randall has worked, you know, among the same kind of people that you talk to many, many of, preparing to write this book.
Yeah, Randall, thank you so much for your call. It makes me choke up, too. I am completely with you on this. It's heartrending to hear the stories and to know what's going on. And this was, you know, what novelists can do is bear witness. And that's what I tried to do in this book. And I want to speak for all those young men.
You did more than read. You also talked with returning vets to put this character of Conrad together. What kind of vets did you talk to? Were they from Iraq, Afghanistan, deployments where?
Only from Iraq and Afghanistan, and I tried mostly to talk to people who'd been in Iraq. And with that limitation, anyone who would talk to me, I talked to. I wanted to hear everything that they had to say, that they wanted to say, about every aspect of their experiences. And I met with them wherever they would meet. I met them in cafes and in their houses and once at a writer's conference, wherever they were. Some I talked to on the phone who were very far away. But it was their stories that I wanted to make real. I wanted to hear everything that they had to say to me. And I talked to their wives and their girlfriends and I wanted everything.
You know, it seems like we've heard a lot about PTSD now over these very long years of war in Iraq and Afghanistan. And then you hear directly from someone like Randall describing how it tears his heart out, and we can hear it. And maybe we haven't heard enough. And what are we still missing at this point? What are we not getting? What nuance are we not getting to, Roxanne?
Well, I think that, I mean, the numbers are horrifying. We have 22 suicides a day. That's 8,000 deaths a year from this war that's over, the war in Iraq. Mm. That's an unacceptable number.
22 a day?
Yes. 22 suicides a day from vets who've come back from Iraq and Afghanistan. It's a terrible, terrible situation. And we have to do more about it. And I think that the more I talk to the vets, it seemed to me that there's silence on both sides of this chasm, that the vets don't know how to talk about their circumstances, their experiences, don't know if they can, and civilians certainly have no idea what they're meant to do or to say. So one vet whom I've stayed close to said that he was glad that I'd written the book. He said it belies something that he had found. He said when he came back, his friends all said to him, well, of course, I could never understand your experience. And so he said that made him feel silenced, that he wasn't allowed mm-hmm. to tell his experience. Mm-hmm. And he said, and now you have told this experience. So you've made it clear. This is proof that it can be told. So civilians can read this and have a sense of what the vets are going through. And the vets can read it and say, my story is being told. I have a voice.
You have a moment where Conrad has just returned. He's sitting down with his parents, and they want to know how he's doing. And it's such an easy question to ask, but such a hard ground to really meet on. It's just a short reading we've got there, but that gives a sense of the difficulty of crossing that chasm of understanding. Could you read a bit of that for us, Roxanna?
Yeah, this is Conrad having his first meal with his parents at a restaurant. His mother says, so, Con, how are you really? He looked at her. His father, too, was waiting. But it was impossible to drag the whole lumbering world of Iraq, hot, smoky, contaminated, the everywhere sand and the sound, that terrible enveloping sound that filled the world, to this table. None of it was transferable, the sound of mortars, the foul black smell of the latrines, setting out through the narrow streets of Haditha, waiting for the sound, the giant earth-stopping sound of explosion. The screen you put between yourself and the rest of the world. He had no words for this. There was no bridge between that place and this. Glad to be back, he said, and smiled.
Glad to be back and smile, but it's not nearly as simple as that. No bridge between that world and this. Roxanna Robinson reading from Sparta. Susan is calling from Shelburne, Vermont. Susan, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hello, Tom.
Hi.
I wanted to relate this to a Vietnamese story, which I'm very aware of. This brings this back in full circle. In Vermont, many National Guards people were sent to Iraq when they were National Guardsmen. And in Vermont, many people need a second job to make a livelihood. And to their shock and dismay, they were sent out of the country, no more National Guard. And I think it shocked a great deal of them. And when Vietnam happened, my boyfriend asked me to shoot him in his leg or his foot so he wouldn't have to go. I didn't, and he went and he was killed. And I know that some people had been approached in the same way during the Iraq War, who had not realized, had not signed up, had not gone for idealism, and family members could not perform that deed, and their loved ones died. It's a horrible feeling to think that you could have saved someone by shooting them. And I just wanted to comment on that, and this book is extremely moving, and I really do believe in my heart there is no bridge, and that's the reason for all the suicides. There just is no bridge. Thank you.
Thank you, Susan. Thank you.
Oh, what a story. What a story.
shoot me and declining, and then he dies. Oh, good God. That means that it's
devastating.
Susan lives with that as well. I want to talk about this. Yeah, please.
There are many stories I've heard about people who went into the National Guard or went into the reserves and were told that they would never be sent out of the country, and then they were.
Weekend warriors who became warriors in Iraq.
Yeah. Well. And it's a failure of trust, on the part of the military. I mean, the thing that happened in Iraq was, since there was no draft, and since we went into this war without realizing what it was going to entail, we ran out of bodies very quickly, and the military was struggling to get people to sign up. Apart from the people who signed up from idealism, as you say, Susan, there are a lot of people who did not want to go in, who had no intention of going, and were told by recruiters that they'd be forest rangers, they would never leave the country, and they found themselves in Iraq. And it's terrible.
And the tour of duty in so many ways longer than the deployment. Josh in Yukon, Oklahoma. Josh, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Yes, thank you, Tom, for taking my call. I actually made a comment to your person receiving phone calls. Mm-hmm. The hardest part about families with that is that I just had my brother this past weekend have a panic attack at my house, and he just went right back to back to Afghanistan. And the best analogy I could come up with for families is that you send off a family member, and when they come back from war, it's kind of like you adopted an adult that is already set in their ways, and they're a totally different person than when they originally left. I think the families are suffering more because you're used to one person, and then they come back, and they're a totally different person, totally different. My brother was very wide open, always laughed, always had jokes. Now it's totally opposite. It's very somber mood, very quiet. The conversations are very obtuse, and there's nothing there to engage in a conversation with him anymore. And so, you know, when he has these panic attacks, it was actually my first one that I witnessed.
Could you tell what set it off, Josh? Could you see why it came?
It was basically just two people. That were there, they were arguing about something stupid on the sports, something about sports.
Yeah,
and it was an argument that ensued, but there was nothing serious. And you know,
and then what happened? How could you tell he was having a panic attack?
Oh, he was there. I mean, he was apologizing to one of his comrades that he lost. He felt like that was his fault, and he shared with me what actually happened, and that was a first. And he's been here since April. So it was real hard for him, or myself, or the family, to actually sit down and, like your guest there had the story about the parents asked the soldier, their son, you know, how do you really feel? And you know, my mom is a master's in criminal psychology and child psychology.
Yeah.
And even her asking that question, she feels like how do you approach something like that?
Roxanne, I don't want to put you in the position of counselor. You're not. But you've thought about it a lot, and you thought about exactly these interactions of siblings and parents and girlfriends and boyfriends with the returning vet. I mean, as you're listening to Josh, he's struggling with this right now. Do you have any advice for him?
It's really excruciating, and I've heard this over and over. And the families are delivered with this, as you say. That's a really good analogy. It's like adopting an adult. This is a new person, and they have no idea of how to respond. And the military doesn't give them any guidelines. And If you're a mother with an MSW, you still don't know how to reach him, and the military isn't offering much solace. The men that I've talked to have gone through it and have gotten better. this has seemed to me to take place through a combination of things. Talking is really helpful if you can do it, if you can find someone that you can talk to. And exercise is really helpful. Yoga has been shown to be helpful. Organic gardening is helpful. So there are ways in which you can draw that energy down a bit, and some people have found some of those activities helpful. But I agree, it is really scary and painful to be in that situation, to see somebody struggling and to have no idea how to help them.
You've got a little bit here where your character, Conrad, sits down with his girlfriend, Claire, and they're trying to deal with it. I mean, you're gone, and then you return. And for each of them, it's, as they say here, kind of abrupt. Could you read a bit of that for us, Roxana, from Sparta?
Yeah, this is Conrad talking to his girlfriend, Claire, and she's sort of having a moment. "It's been 4 years, Con," Claire said. "You can't just arrive home and move back in. My life is different. Things aren't the way they were before. This is too abrupt." "It's too abrupt for you," said Conrad. "How do you think it is for me?" "Okay," said Claire nervously. I know." Conrad swiveled to face her. "How do you know? How do you have any idea what it's like for me? To be over there and see my friends die? And then to come home and be told to go slow? That this is too abrupt?" He paused. "What am I supposed to do? How am I supposed to arrive less abruptly? You want me to just come home from Iraq for weekends? Arrive in stages?" "Okay," said Claire. She fanned out her hands. "Okay." She sounded frightened.
From Sparta there, Roxana Robinson reading. So many of the people at home are nervous, frightened, as you say there. Not because they don't love the returning vet. They do, but they just don't know how to interact. And the vet, you write, at one point you write, "What made him so wild, what made his throat swell with rage, was the fact that no one here," that's at home, "knew anything. No one here understood about the real world. That world of war has been imprinted on him as some kind of real world as opposed to this world," Roxana.
Yeah, everyone I spoke to felt that that the place they had been really could not be integrated with the place they had come back to. And there was the place they had been was, it's so extreme being in a war zone. There's so much adrenaline, there's so much at risk, there's so much peril constantly. So much boredom, so much sweating, so much, it's just so extreme. It's not like everyday life here. And to come back and to have that ignored or unremarked is infuriating and devastating for the vets.
And yet, people don't know how to ask. They don't, you know, they say, "How was it really?" That's his parents' attempt. That's their effort. How was it really, Con?
That's the gap. So the parents are doing the best they can, and his mother is an MSW, so she understands that there is a problem, and she is incapable of fixing it.
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour about Roxana Robinson's new novel of a U.S. Marine coming home from war, from Iraq. It is called Sparta. Roxana joins us from New York City. It's a remarkable book that goes very deep on the experience that so many Americans have now had, but many others have not. And it gets to the point of national responsibility, all our responsibility, since this war, of course, was carried out in our name. Roxana Robinson's book is Sparta. Russ calls from Auburn, Alabama. Russ, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. I'm a veteran of Army and the Navy. And I was listening to the program the other day, and they spoke about the guy from Texas, and he had his mother and stepfather on, and there was this song that his stepfather had introduced him to, and he called about the getting his second deployment, and so he told his stepfather they were going to go to this concert. Anyway, while home, he purchased a revolver, and he took his own life. I'm just hitting here and there. And when I heard that, it, like, was pouring salt into the wound. having been in the Army, I never did go to the actual, what I call hot spots. I was the ready unit. We were signed to the, but seeing the limbs and the arms, minus, we processed them back.
Yeah.
And so, though I never did hit the hot spots per se, like the Tet or the Kabul or the, all the different, but being a ready unit and getting the first hand, you know, you got a soldier and half his head, his calf is gone and all that. It's no words to describe how it feels and what it does to you. And I think about when I first ETS, how I must have seen to my parents, you know?
Yeah, just coming back from helping others come back from war. Russ, I appreciate your call there from Auburn. Roxana has her character Conrad. He's asked by a doctor at the VA about his symptoms, and he has written them down. And he lists them for the doctor: anxiety, insomnia, panic, flashbacks, hypervigilance, depression, mood swings, rage, impotence, being a jerk, being unable to concentrate or focus on anything. And how about, she writes, being unable to rely on himself for anything, not even for being civil to his family or his girlfriend. Dan in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, you're on the air, Dan. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I wanted to tell you about a program that the Marine Corps has where it's wounded, injured, and ill. And it's really a great program. It's called Semper Fi Odyssey. Can you hear me okay, Tom?
Yes, we can. Thank you, Dan.
Okay. And they started about 6 years ago when they formed a Wounded Warrior Regiment with a battalion on the East Coast and a battalion on the West Coast. All the Marines that are wounded, injured, and ill that are being medically discharged go to this program right about the time they're getting ready to leave the Marine Corps for an intensive week of transitioning. The really key to this is that guys like me who were infantry officers in Vietnam come back to be team leaders for them, and we're with them from 7:30 in the morning until 7:30 at night, and there's six specific tools that we work with them on that help them plan the rest of their lives and also deal with all the demons that they may have, post-traumatic stress, etc. And the really great part about the program is that now they're beginning to cycle what we've learned back into new troops that are being taken into the Marine Corps with programs like mind-based mind fitness training, OSCAR, which is occupational stress control and readiness, COSLA, which is combat and operational stress first aid. And so the veterans leaving now, supported by Vietnam veterans, are giving feedback back to the new guys coming in. And I just wanted your listeners to know that the Marine Corps really has a great national program for its wounded, injured, and ill.
Semper Fi Odyssey. I'm sure they can find it online, Dan, and I appreciate you telling us about it from Pittsburgh. I really do. Roxana, your character has a pretty tough interaction with what's available from the VA. I don't know if you ever got into this more elaborate Marine program or not. His VA interaction, not so good in your telling. Dan, sounds like they've got a pretty thorough effort going on in that corner, at least.
That program sounds terrific. I'm very glad to know about it. I'm going to look it up. The VA presented a wide spectrum of experience. There were some people who had a good experience going there and some people who had a really desperate, terrible time.
I mean, you've got him, he waits months to get in. He gets there. The doctor, you know, listens with one ear. He's taking phone calls when he does it. Seems like 5 seconds, and he says, okay, so I'm going to prescribe you 3 medications, trazodone and gabapentin and paroxetine or whatever it is, and off you go. See you in another 3 months. For your character, that's not enough.
Yeah, there's the people, again, this condition of the vets is really not at all addressed by the military response. So these guys that show up, who, first of all, they have to overcome their military training, which is don't complain, don't show weakness, don't admit weakness. So a lot of them are very reluctant to come forward in the first place. And when they do finally overcome that, they go, they're often told to wait for 3 months. They're often told then to wait for another 3 months for another appointment. And that's when a lot of people are lost. I mean, there are a lot of these guys are on suicide watch, and they're told to come back in 3 months. And that's not a kind of an effective response. So that's really another terrible situation.
Let me get a call here from Jeff in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Jeff, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Roxanne. Great program. I've never called, first time caller.
Great.
I just wanted to make a comment to offer another view. When Roxanne had mentioned that perhaps some people were kind of goaded into coming into the military, and were told, oh, you'd never have to do this or never have to do that.
Oh, she was saying the National Guard she was talking about there, that they didn't, it wasn't their expectation, but okay.
Well, I've just retired from the Naval Reserve. I've served both with Army guardsmen.
Mm-hmm.
And over the past, 13 years, I've been in the rooms, and when a general officer or an admiral has said, how many of you have come back in or stayed in after 9/11? A significant number of hands went up. And, there were a number of people who made a conscious decision to say, I'm going to stay during this period. And I know, and what I used to tell my folks was the random act of violence that you could walk in as a reservist and your spouse could say, hey, the reserve center just called. You have to leave in 24 hours. That's always been the unwritten rule. I've served both in the active capacity and the reserve programs. And that was always what I told people, that forgetting your pay and other benefits from weekend to weekend, within a 24-hour period, you could be called and you could be pressed into service for any myriad of reasons.
You know, Jeff, there's no question that's true. I absolutely agree. Everybody understands that's the deal. At the same time, for many years, that was the kind of deployments that we saw the National Guard and presumably Navy Reserves as well to Iraq were way outside the experience of most people for a long, long time. Were they not, Jeff?
No, that really ended in the first Gulf War, and I had transitioned off my ship to a reserve center just after the first Gulf War wound down in 91.
Yeah.
And that's when the first major mobilization started happening of the reserve. And there were people with stories coming out then that I never expected this to happen. But after that, with Kosovo and then with the drawdown and with almost half of the forces in theater right now being reserve component. Tom, you walk into most commands now, and a quarter to a half of the day in and day out folks are reservists in some recall capacity. But that pendulum started to shift, and so the folks who couldn't withstand that, and this is not a mark on them, the folks who said, you know what, I can't be pulled out because my job, my family, those people could walk away, but when you made the decision at the next time to stay on. I don't want to be cold-hearted about it, but the fact is it's called an armed service. Whether you're in the Coast Guard, the National Guard, which could be federalized, it's an armed service. And I always tell people, the benefits are great, but if it's extra pay you're seeking, go to a commercial industry.
Yeah, Jeff, we've got it, and I appreciate your call. I mean, it has gone deep. There have been plenty of wars. The Gulf War, there was the Kosovo intervention, there were more, and then these very long ones. I mean, Roxanne, I wonder how you're thinking about that depth of deployment here. You write late in the book. I mean, you title the book Sparta. You've got a classics major. This is fiction, so that's optional, and yet you do it. You write, at one point in the book, you write, Sparta failed in the end because the energies of the state were directed only toward war. And you're talking ancient history here, literally ancient history. Robbed of its young men, the country became hollowed out from within, and what remained was a hard, burnished carapace. This repelled the enemy and expanded outward, pushing into the rest of the world, but it had no heart from which to draw sustenance. The costs of war were great both to the nation and to the soldiers. Are you drawing a parallel with the United States, where such a relatively small percentage of our population actually fights the wars?
Of course, we are not a military state like Sparta. We don't force all of our male citizens to become warriors. I'm simply drawing the reader's attention to what happens when the affairs of war take this kind of precedence, and without counting the costs. There are costs to imposing this kind of wartime experience on people. And we're not, I don't think we are acknowledging those costs. Of course, this last caller is correct that if you go into the reserves, you have to expect to be called up. I'm talking about other situations in which I've heard people say that the recruiters lied to them and told them that they were going into the National Guard and they would do national service. And one girl in Colorado went in because she wanted to get money for college, and the recruiter told her that she would never leave the country. She would be doing work in the national parks, and she was immediately sent to Iraq, and she was terrified, would never have done it, did not understand that that was what she was getting into. And that was not a single incident. So, of course, there are people who go into the reserves and must recognize that they're putting themselves at risk for the future. But in this war, we are seeing an extraordinary rate of suicides from our vets coming home. And I'm saying we simply have to be aware of the cost, the consequences of this kind of undeclared war that is drawing on people who are sent there and then have to come back. And we have a civilian community that doesn't know how to deal with them, and they don't know how to deal with their situation.
When he's on the airplane, just coming home, your character, Conrad, a flight attendant, a middle-aged woman, I guess, sees him awake when many others are sleeping, and while they sleep, she says to him, "Thank you for your service." This is something I think a lot of Americans, maybe a lot of our listeners, have done at some point in the last 10 years to someone coming home from these wars. But his reaction is not gratitude for her saying that. He's kind of bitter about her saying that to him. Why, Roxana?
I think it seems like a very facile response. It's very easy. He suddenly recognizes it's so easy for a civilian to say that and then to feel that this stewardess may feel that she has paid her debt. She's done all she needs to. She's fulfilled her obligations to a vet, a returning vet, by saying, "Thank you for your service." And that's it. That's all she needs to say. And he is embittered by the idea that she also thinks that what he's done there, which boils down into sometimes horrifying and degrading behavior, shooting people that shouldn't be shot, or watching your comrades die, that she thinks somehow that's made her life safer. And the idea of the facility, the ease, and the fact that she's smiling as she says it is just arouses a deep sense of resentment and bitterness.
And he's not at all sure he's made her safer. What happens in the course of the book to his sense of, from his study of the classics, as you say, and the glorification that sometimes goes on there in the old tellings, the bard's tellings, what happens to his sense of the nobility of war in the process of these deployments?
Well, you know, there are different kinds of wars, and I think in this country there's a general feeling that World War II was a morally defensible war, that we had to fight it. We understood who the enemy was. We understood that our allies and our way of life was in danger. But that's not true of the war in Iraq. Most people had no idea why we were going. Most people couldn't find it. Many people couldn't find it on a map. It turns out there were no weapons of mass destruction. Saddam Hussein had no connection to Osama bin Laden. So we've lost thousands of young men, and we're losing them still. And so there's a tremendous sense of moral ambiguity and a sense of dissolution of purpose, and I think it's devastating for the national consciousness, both for civilians and veterans.
Ben is calling from New York City. Ben, thanks. You're on the air.
Hi, how are you? Well, first of all, hello, Tom and Roxanne, and I just want to congratulate you on a book that I've just cut into. I happen to be from a military family. My grandfather and my father were both the generals George Patton. And
rather famous military family, I'd say.
Yeah, somewhat. Yeah. The reason I'm calling those is because I wanted to touch on the fact that these are 21st century wars, and many of the participants are of that YouTube generation. And when we're talking about the suicide rate, I've started an initiative that hopefully other people will expand on, and that is using filmmaking as a collaborative tool in the recovery of a soldier. It's an inherently collaborative medium, very effective tool of communication, and so it's a chance for someone who may not be able to speak about something they've dealt with, but be able to express it through a film.
And to tell the story somehow, in this case, through film, to get it off their chest, to get it out there, to share it.
Exactly, and also collaborate with civilian filmmakers who, unlike the Vietnam War, this generation is looking for a way to engage. This is the other 99% are looking for a way to engage with many of these returning veterans, and it's called IWasThereFilms.org, and it's just a new initiative that I thought was relevant to your discussion.
Very relevant.
That's great.
IWasThereFilms.org, great grandson of General Patton. Ben, thank you. Our time is so short, but I thank you for your call. Roxana, what lesson did you come to from this about how to get through this? Is it just time? Is it interaction?
Every vet had a different story, and some of them were still in a very dark place, and some of them had moved through it. And as I say, I think that the most important thing is awareness and the family feeling that they can talk to each other, they can talk to other people. There are organizations, we've heard from several during this hour. Mm-hmm. There are places who are ready to help. But I think being aware and making the vet understand that you're there to do whatever you can is really important. The most important thing is that we know.
Your book itself, Sparta, is a remarkable act of deep empathy, and I appreciate you putting the work into it, Roxana, the work of empathy, and appreciate your sharing it with us today.
Thank you so much, Tom. It's a pleasure to be here.
Roxana Robinson, her new book is Sparta. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Thanks for joining us today. Tomorrow in this hour, we will look at the president's new moves on climate change and the likely impact of those moves, climate-wise, economy-wise. Join us for that. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.